One day, you finally knew what you had to do, and began. Though the voices around you kept shouting their bad advice, though the whole house began to tremble, and you felt the old tug at your ankles. "Mend my life," each voice cried. But you didn't stop. You knew what you had to do, though the wind pried with its stiff fingers at the very foundations, though their melancholy was terrible. It was already late enough, and a wild night, and the road full of fallen branches and stones, but little by little, as you left their voices behind, the stars began to burn through the sheets of clouds, and there was a new voice, which you slowly recognized as your own, that kept you company as you strode deeper and deeper into the world, determined to do the only thing you could do, determined to save the only life you could save.
This is WGXC 90.7 FM, Acra, Catskill, and Hudson, New York, broadcasting locally and globally online at WGXC.org. And today we're live in the Hudson studio. This is the Art of the Hudson Valley, and I'm your host, Chad Weckler. And we have another full studio and a full hour ahead. I'm going to ask David Anderson to introduce himself, since he eloquently read that poem, and maybe he'll talk about that poem. And we're going to be speaking with David for a little bit here.
Yes, it's a Mary Oliver poem called The Journey. Many people might know it. And it seemed we were trying to think of what we might lead with, and this one came up partly because that journey that's described is, of course, familiar to anyone in an artistic process as well as a life process, which who isn't? And so it felt like a good lead-in for us.
And does it have any association with your current production that actually debuts this evening?
A little bit. It came up in rehearsal. It was interesting because we were talking about this part, as described in the poem, you know, when this change is asked of you, when you're on that edge and you're asked beyond your comfort zone, it's never when everything's comfortable. It's always when the road is full of fallen branches and stones. And it's hard in the midst of those situations to really listen to that new voice that is always beckoning us on. And of course, in the rehearsal process, as you get further on, all these other things that crowd around and ask for answers, like lighting and design and costumes, all this stuff that can encroach that process, it can become hard to hear that voice of the play or whatever one's working with that is leading us on into some new possibility. And it's never comfortable. I guess we were at that point in the process where it's always a little bit, you know, we're at an edge in ourselves because something new wants to be born, as in any point. You know, when something new wants to happen, there's always that little bit of edge.
And what's the play about? Describe it.
Eurydice is, well, it's probably a familiar story. It's basically the Orpheus legend. Everyone knows about that probably from school, right? Orpheus goes in the underworld. I mean, the part that we probably all remember from school is that his wife dies, or his love dies, and he's so grief-stricken that he creates the world's saddest music, and even all the animals and trees and even the stones weep because he's such a powerful musician, and he's determined to penetrate the underworld and bring her back out. And he creates such extraordinary music that he opens the gates of the underworld, and he's told that she will follow him as long as he doesn't turn around to see if she's behind him. And of course, as fate would have it, he does. But in our play, it's a little different because it's a 21st century play. It's written by a very young playwright. Well, not very young. She's 37. I guess it's all relative where you stand. Yeah. Depends on where you stand on what side of that. And it's a beautiful new visioning of this story, but from the perspective of Eurydice, his wife. And it's set in a very modern situation. And when I met Sarah Rule, the playwright's work, I'd seen a play done in the Berkshires last year, the Melancholy Play. And I was so struck by this voice of, and I said to myself, I'd never heard such a voice in theater like this, this freshness of this language, which really felt like a language for our time, like a new expressiveness in theater. Also, her work with image. And I started, I went and bought a bunch of her plays, started reading them, and realized that there was something here. And then somebody said, you know, the play that you might be interested in is called Eurydice. And as soon as somebody mentioned the name, I knew we were going to be doing that one. Even though I hadn't talked about with the co-producers, but I just had a feeling and I read it. And as I said this morning, we were on WAMC this morning, I said it was like love at first read, because as soon as I read it, there was just so much there, and it just felt, you know how everything sort of falls into place when you find that thing where then everything becomes relevant, has a relevancy about it or a meaningfulness, and that's what happened. And then it's been a pretty exciting journey since. I've said a lot more than just what the play's about, but that is what the play's about as well.
Also, you have Jonathan Talbot, musician, having done the music.
Yeah, he's been our music director for many years, in at least the last, certainly the last four productions at PS21. And his, you know, he is the best at what he does that I know. Somebody who really is able to listen into the play and understand how that play can be expressed through music as well. So he actually adds another voice, almost like another character, to the piece. It's not like tagged on. It's really woven into it. He has such an ear for that, such a sensitivity as well about how that can work, and always looking for how can music really serve the whole piece. And he's just extraordinary with it. And so this time we went even further, and we have a little chamber ensemble that is going to perform his compositions live on stage with the actors. And we've already been working with the musicians and having them do ensemble exercises with us so that they're not just on the side, but actually woven into the whole fabric of it.
Explain a Walking the Dog theatrical production.
I mean, you could do that probably, couldn't you? Certain people often talk about the minimalist aspect too, that very not high production values in the sense of like a lot of accoutrement. Although, you know, every production has its needs, and we have done productions that have a lot of set and a lot of other things. This one has a little bit of that, but certainly I would say, if anything probably characterizes our work, it's probably the work with the ensemble. Mm-hmm. So, for example, we almost worked 2 full weeks before we even started blocking the play, just on building up with these 7 actors a relationship, a sense of each other, how they work together, what is their rhythm as a group, and every day tuning into where are we as a group, what is that substance between us. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting, especially with this group, because this group, I felt with also the smaller size, was particularly open to exploring ensemble possibilities like never before. So we did a lot of ensemble work. And once that's developed, like once you have a good relationship with somebody, right, it's not like you have to build all this trust and all this substance between you, then it was like the play directed itself. I was getting a bit nervous. We'd done so much ensemble work that we hadn't even touched the play really directly as far as how it's going to look. But then once we did, it just kind of fell into place. It really felt like the play was directing itself, because so much was there. And once the play sort of found its way into that, it just made sense how it should all look, how it works. Mm. And so we were able to find a form quite organically. It wasn't like then, okay, this is what needs to happen now, but, oh, try this, this, and then it just sort of fell into itself. And what particularly what I like, and maybe this is distinguishing our work a little bit, is the use of movement and the work with space. So using space as a real substance as well. As in, what does that mean really? That is a bit abstract, isn't it? But that how people move in the space actually shifts the experience the audience has. And so there's characters in this who there are 3 stones. And basically we've created a choreography for them through the whole course of the play, which makes it kind of a dance. Even though they're actors, they're not dancers, so we're not actually having them dance. But how their awareness of how they move in the space becomes dance-like, in the sense that they're not expressing themselves with expressions, facial expressions and huge gestures, but they're moving the space with their bodies. And that sounds a little abstract, but it's really in service of the play. So how the drama unfolds is in relationship to we find movement that works with that.
Well, also PS21 that you're at is a very intimate performance space. Can you explain a little bit of your experience there?
I just love PS21 because, well, intimate with nature, because you're outside. It's this futuristic, those who haven't been there, futuristic looking tent. You've been there?
Yes.
Yeah. And have you guys been there? It's
beautiful.
It looks kind of like in a power shell. It's kind of like an open tent, and it's open to the nature outside on one end, open into an apple orchard over in Chatham, overlooking Chatham. And then the the stage is inside that. And so you're always including the elements. And that was another part of our process, is including everything that's around. And so it's intimate, and yet, I mean, if you have to work in theater in the summer, it beats a black box any day. I mean, to be outside among the birds, and we've had such a beautiful summer so far out there. So to rehearse outdoors all day long, it's like, it's heaven. And to be creative and to find things out there. And a lot of it takes place in kind of a, it includes, it's a lot of room for including nature. It's not like an indoor drama. There's lots of room for making this space work. And of course, last year we did Our Town, and you know, you finish, and you know, he talks about the stars, and the audience literally can look overhead and they see the whole expanse canopy of the heavens in front of them, over them.
You've also performed other places than PS21.
Well, our home has been at Basilica for a while, and we still have a sort of stage-like thing in there. But we also move around. We've been a bit vagabond. We are at Space 360. A lot of our shows this year will be at Space 360. And however, we also just met with the town board of Philmont last week to look at a possible home there mm-hmm. for us. So we are sort of half looking for a home, but I very much like to be a little vagabond, because depending on the piece, you can choose the venue, and we have really great collaborators. I mean, Judith at Space 360 and Judy at PS21, all of these are really wonderful relationships. And that's the great thing about this working in this community, is that the relationships are a part of the creative process as well.
And you do a wonderful job with your improv group.
Well, yeah. Well, that's thanks. they're probably the most fun thing yeah. that I feel that we do, because it's low. There's no overhead. You just show up and you see what happens. And we perform every month. And last month we performed twice. And had, despite some really cool evenings, we had really good attendance. Mm. And we still also now we're just being hired out and going into places, and companies are hiring us to do benefits and stuff like that. And that's been a lot of fun. It's great. And that's, speaking of, you know, we've been working for 4 years, that ensemble, seven of us. Mm. And now there's such a substance there. We even in rehearsal, like we performed last Friday at an event, and we came an hour and a half earlier, and we just improv the whole time and had as much fun during the rehearsal as we did in the performance.
Do you think you could ever do radio improv?
Yeah, possibly.
I mean, you there's a lot of physicality in your improvising.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. Why not? It's done, isn't it? I mean, we could, there's lots of sketches. There's so many sketches we could work with. And certainly there's lots that we could do, even if you only can hear us.
I'll think about that.
Yeah, good.
We also have in the studio a lot more people that we're all, you know, here in community radio, we've brought a lot of the community into our studio this afternoon. And you've been listening to David Anderson. And I'm going to go around the room. We're going to share a couple of mics. And have everybody introduce themselves at this point.
Hi, I'm Kara Benson from Malay Colony for the Arts. It's good to be here, Chad. Thanks.
And that's in Austerlitz?
Austerlitz, New York. It's just, I guess it's about 40 minutes, depending upon if you're behind a smart car doing 20, which I was getting here. So it depends.
You made it just in the nick of time.
Just in the nick of time.
And explain the Malay Colony.
Malay Colony for the Arts is an artist residency program that was founded in 1973 by Norma Malay, the poet Edna St. Vincent Malay's sister, on the property that Edna lived at and where she actually also passed. We've been, since 1973, we've hosted thousands of visual artists, composers, writers of all stripes on our gorgeous, pastoral, lovely, beautiful blueberry picking campus. We have 6 to 7 artists a month come stay. We feed them. We provide them private studio space and private bedrooms and lots of love and gorgeous surrounds so that they can submerge in their work. Right now we have three poets. We happen to have three poets there, a composer, a fiction writer, and a visual artist.
I'll come back to you, Kara.
Okay.
And we've got two photographers here who will be showing, are actually showing today. Is the first day of the Kari Haddad Gallery, Photograph Gallery, and Nicholas and Richard.
Hi, I'm Nicholas Gahn of Gahn and Selesnik.
And I'm Richard Selesnik of Gahn and Selesnik.
A team.
a team.
And what's going on at the Photograph Gallery? What is your show?
Yeah, we have an opening coming up this Saturday from 6 to 8 p.m. of our most recent project, which is called Mars Adrift on the Hourglass Sea.
It's a show of about 25 or so photographs taken sort of on Mars, partly by the rover, partly by us.
Yeah, we went out to the Southwest and photographed out there for a few weeks and then combined our images with NASA images. It actually started because we did a project about going to the moon, and so NASA commissioned us to make a photograph about going to Mars, so that was kind of the impetus that started us off on the project.
And as a team, some of you, one of you can do something that the other can't, and the other does something that the other cannot, and you do things that you can do together, and thus we have Mars.
Hmm. Yeah, both of us conceive of the project. It's all through endless chats and drawings back and forth, and we both shoot the projects, but I'm more often creating sets, props, costumes, doing a lot of the research.
And I'm more often, after we've actually taken all the pictures, trying to kind of make images on the computer. But we also try and switch off because we can get a little bored if we're just stuck in one aspect of what we do. So we kind of switch off also.
So what can a viewer expect when they come into the gallery?
Well, traditionally, actually, we're well known for doing panoramas. Since 95, we've been doing about 6-foot-long panoramic images, 360-degree viewpoints, which are involved in this project. But for this show here, we decided to go against our own natural tendencies and show only the squares. So it is square images from a foot square to 4 feet square that are all images of these two women who made it up to Mars and were exploring through time and space across the desert there.
It'll be kind of a complete kind of immersion in this kind of Mars of the imagination that we've created. And there'll also be, as well as the photographs, there'll be some sculptural pieces too.
Speaking of that story, so two women have gone to Mars. Why?
I think the notion is that there's been some kind of unnamed catastrophe on Earth, and somehow either physically or kind of using kind of meditation, they've kind of escaped and gone to Mars. And there's this notion that they're trying to kind of listen back to see what's happened to the Earth. But, you know, there's...
Not good news?
There's no news. And it's probably... And no news probably isn't good news.
No.
But so in the photographs, you'll see there are a lot of these kind of large listening devices, and that may have been kind of left there by some previous attempt to colonize Mars. So there's the sense that,
great amounts of time and space has gone on. When these women are traveling around there, you see landscapes that seem to be very new. Some of the buildings seem new, and then you see the same landscape. It appears a millennia after in ruins. So there's references to Piranesi and ancient Rome and the fall of a great empire, and they're oblique ways of talking about what feels the glories of our American civilization, where it's come from and where it's going, and kind of our sadness at our lack of ability to actually get to places anymore as marvelous as Mars, and glory in that we have gotten there with our rovers, and how little of our mind and power of our culture is going towards really continuing to explore places like that.
Yeah, so it's kind of allegory.
Speaking, poetry seems to be a common thread that's all of a sudden is in the studio. Kara, what are, when you have poets who come to Malay, explain those artists. Where do they come from? What are they trying to find in their poetry?
That's as varied as the people who come, of course.
That's cool.
We do tend to get a lot of folks from Brooklyn, I'll say that. a lot of visual artists come from Brooklyn. I think, again, the poets come with, a variety of projects that they're working on. Typically, though, that is what we find is that they, what I can say that is similar is that they are at work on a specific project. They're, of course, everyone artists love the idea of just time aside to create and sort of linger in the creative process or thinking about it. And even if there's no work generated specifically, work that seems to manifest at the time there, literally, tangibly, the time spent there in process, either whether it's resisting the making or actually something opens up and the making happens there, we've heard from people on the other side of their time that that time was crucial to their process, that something suddenly that they were avoiding thinking about at the colony suddenly, you know, that pressure was really became productive at some point later on. But mostly what we find is that, and we see it in the artist statements in the application process, that people are really after something specific in their work. And that, again, is as varied as the poets that come. Right now we have a poet who is, and I want to talk about her project because it's so interesting, but I don't know that I have her permission to do it. Let me just, there's this great story I could tell you, but I can't. I'm teetering on telling, okay. Aren't I? Yeah.
How does one get a residency at the colony?
That's an excellent question. You apply and pray, I think. competition is high to get in, I would love for somebody, even just at my own home, to feed me, you know, and that, you know, that it's a valued space. It's a pretty, I would say, user-friendly application process. We ask for, of course, a work sample, which varies depending upon your medium. For visual artists, they send. Actually, now it's all done online, which is so phenomenal and just so much smoother than it had been. We save so much paper and so much time. There's a great software interface that we use. And you upload your images, or you upload your manuscripts, or you upload your pieces of score, and then we have a jury in each medium that that anonymously chooses the residents. And we had close to 650 applicants for 48 slots last year. So
I've actually been on the jury a couple times.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, no, it's an amazing process. You learn a lot about the trends that are going on today in the art schools and out in the realm, and it's exciting, and there's some clunkers, but there's a lot of really great stuff there, and it's really hard to choose.
It's really hard to choose. I've sat in on the juries, as a writer myself, and other situations I've been on juries, and it's really hard to choose. And then suddenly the work, I find that, as opposed to, say, if I'm picking up a book and it's already published and on the shelf, I might give it, Not always, but a little bit more the benefit of the doubt. But when you're in the process of sitting there, specifically, you're called to judge this work.
It's people's lives, and it's really scary that your personal prejudice might change this person's opportunity to make something amazing. And you take it really seriously, and the discussion is extremely exciting, actually.
It's the discussions are really in-depth, really rigorous. I love sitting in on the jury process because we'll find that the theoretical considerations that, as you say, are happening out in the field or sort of floating in our consciousness or collective unconscious, if you will, really come to the fore. And there have been some really dynamic conversations around that table, some nearly contentious, but in a really positive way that friction, artistic friction, can create.
When you bring all the artists together in a residency, it sounds like they all are there for mealtime. and they're all at the same table, and they're all sharing ideas. Does that happen?
Absolutely. We have, in fact, a number of collaborations that come out of residencies, people who go on to stay in touch and do work together. I edit a journal now for the colony called Edna that is based, we take from the work made at the colony. And I see suddenly in epigraphs to dedicated to so-and-so for the someone that they worked with at the colony. Suddenly someone is in somebody else's script. They start to infiltrate each other's work while they're there, and then go on to create other works, stay in touch and create other works together. So they definitely, the conversations, the cross-genre mingling is happening, and we love that. We love that that happens at the table. They start inviting each other to each other's studios to look at work. We do little, you know, they sometimes spontaneously create informal sort of showcase nights at the Colony. We used to do them a little bit more formally here in Hudson. We've done events at the Spotty Dog and also at the Hudson Opera House where our residents will come out and show. And while that was wonderful, I think the thing that was most exciting for us and the people that took part in it was the residents seeing each other's work. So instead of putting, because a lot of the residency is thinking about being in sort of the, the womb of creativity, if you will, there's sort of this private enclave that it felt somehow coming out into the world wasn't, didn't seem to fit quite as much. Though I expect that we'll do more public programming as people wish. We always make that available if they like, and if not, they can stay and show each other, and that happens, as I said, just kind of spontaneously.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah, absolutely.
You'd mentioned the trends that are coming up. I would be interested in hearing from what you've seen, what are the trends you notice even throughout the arts, questions that artists are working with, themes that come up, anything that is particularly a thread that you can observe amongst all artists?
Well, I would just echo that what I've heard already in the show here is, you know, the concern for the planet. You know, what are we doing? How, you know, what does it mean to be human now on this biosphere that we're trashing? Did I just say that out loud?
You did. Yeah.
That's my personal opinion, not necessarily Malay's opinion.
And also, I would say, certainly in the room, there's a lot of collaboration that goes on. Both Richard and Nicholas are collaborating, artists at Malay, and certainly David, your entourage, your
ensemble.
I think collaboration is now not. I feel that a lot of people are partnering together, sharing ideas. Saying, if you give me a place, I'll make something to go in it, just like your roving acting. So let's talk about collaborating. David, I'll go to you. What's the best part of that, and how do, and I know you do a lot of work with a lot of the Columbia County youth, mm-hmm. Going to the schools and helping, teaching. What's that like, going to the schools?
What's it like? It is, it's another aspect. It was funny, when you said collaboration, I immediately thought of this conversation I was having with Pamela Badilla just outside, because she's creating these radio shows and that are about community building, but at the same time, she's describing the process of creating the radio show as building a community. And how even in a school, even wherever an artistic project, especially theater, I'm sure it's the case elsewhere, but every time you join some people who maybe didn't work together before, in our case, maybe we have a few people who've worked together before, every new project is building a new community. And it's interesting because then you sort of learn the process of community building all over again. And you sometimes make the same mistakes again and fall into the same pitfalls, or you get wise. And I think the joys of the work, also with young people, is that you kind of develop an understanding of this mysterious world of relationship, relating to others and creating together. And if you have to create together, you have to rub off some of your edges or develop something to expand yourself or stretch yourself. So collaboration, in a way, I would say, is the best way to learn not only where you are and your own limitations and strengths, but also what's possible with another and how that wouldn't be possible without an other.
Well, how, you know, speaking as artists, how rusty can your tool get if you don't use it? If you don't write, if you don't pick up a camera, if you're not acting, how dangerous is that?
You can definitely get rusty. It's like an athlete. Your muscles can atrophy, and then the whole process can seem a little terrifying. One of the good things about collaboration is, you know, if you get into that state, then there's someone who's going to jog you right out of it and kind of challenge you to you know, to keep creating and to try and get out of some of the tendencies you might be kind of stuck in?
Recently, about 3 months ago, 4 months ago, I took on a challenge. I hadn't drawn from the figure since college 25 years ago directly. I've been drawing all along, but here in Hudson at the Opera House, they have once a week, a group of people get together with a nude model. And our most recent project that we're working on producing now is about bats. And I've decided I'm going there. I'm going to challenge myself to learn to draw from the figure again. But instead of the figure as it is, I'm placing the kind of face of a bat on the figures of the people who are there posing. And it's been a great challenge. I'm trying to mix drawing live from a human, collaborating with that person there who's posing in various ways. And then from those poses, I'm seeing a scene that's inside a narrative I'm slowly building. And then these scenes I'm drawing there, I then afterwards show to Richard, and we think about how that scene that's been forming from that mix of us might be something that we'll photograph out there in nature. And we noticed there's these cliffs in Mohonk nearby that we're going to go out and take these same sort of half-nude bats and try and shoot the figures out there to repeat that kind of sort of almost depressing, suicidal feeling these bats are having because the world is kind of coming apart in their world in there. So that's another, a very rusty thing for me was drawing, but I've been totally enjoying pushing myself on that end.
I think just as a general comment, what's great about collaboration is it introduces a element of unpredictability.
Mm.
So you can be very stuck in your own way of looking at things and approaches to things. But as soon as you start collaborating, then suddenly all kinds of things start coming from left field. And that's kind of what's so exciting about it.
Go ahead, David.
Well, you said an image come up, but I'm sure you get images all the time. How do you decide what direction to take? I mean, especially if you're knowing that you're going to do it together. How do you ever decide on, well, let's go this route?
That can be very difficult. We have, a huge stack of images that seemed fascinating at the time, but for one reason or another, we never kind of, went down that alleyway. It's hard to say. I think usually what happens is you'll come up with an image that's so compelling that you'll actually step towards it, and then the next thing you know, you're committing a huge
towards
amount
towards you.
It
moves towards you.
Or
then.
It moves towards you, yeah.
But it's hard to tell. It feels like often that the novel is writing itself. We see our bodies of work as novels. We're given clues by these images, and then another image comes from Richard, and that alters the course of the novel, and then something will come from me, and we're just seeing how those collide with the things that we're listening to, the trends we're sensing in nature, in people around us, the community here, and it really does write itself or draw itself.
Also, I don't know if you find this, but sometimes someone will make a suggestion and they'll make a suggestion just casually, not even necessarily in earnest, but something about it will sound so compelling that, soon you find yourself going down that alleyway which you didn't expect.
I'm going to go to Kara. Some of the things that you talked about, the application process and in a way that's collaborative effort to make these tough choices. From the artist's point of view, what helps make a better application or when you're looking at artists, what jumps out at you?
One of the things that we first suggest to people is send your best work. Often people think they should send what they will be working on, something that's in process, something that might be really raw, and that isn't necessarily the best course of action. It's not something that is so signature that the jury might recognize it if you're an artist that's been out there. Your standard work, I would say send the work that it just sings to you and for you and of you.
Something you feel very confident about.
Right,
and
exactly.
Strongly.
Yeah. And I would even say, I mean, I love this idea of the casual suggestion. I'm a huge fan of the one-off, the odd moment, the odd quirk. So even it can be that work that everybody else, that you just, for some reason, you just love. You just love that purple couch in the middle of that painting. You know what I mean? Everybody else doesn't get it, but boy, that just strikes you as your best piece. That's the one to send. The other thing is definitely consider the artist statement. The juries take the artist statements very seriously because they can really see inside the artist and what they're after, what they're thinking about, what their concerns are. And I think that is the sign of someone who's in some kind of process of maturation around their work, is that they're really really thinking about it, really puzzling with it, really struggling with it, really working on it on a number of levels, not necessarily just emotionally or physically or intuitively or intellectually, but sort of we might see a number of registers communicated. And I think that is something that would often stands out to juries. But I want to get back to, if I can, sure, to the just the idea of collaboration and what is some of the themes that I see or that we see. And we definitely have people that that are applying not only as collaborators and are requesting to come together as collaborators, and we do accommodate that, but people that might come as one half of a collaboration, that they're working on their part of the collaboration. We are seeing a lot more people working in collaboration. And I see myself personally a lot of people grappling with the idea of the commons and where did we go wrong as a society, and I think artists are some of the people that are working on how to have there's a lot of talk around the gift economy among poets, and like how to have this barter exchange, a different sense of community that is facilitated by artistic exchange that isn't completely removed from the personal mediated by, capitalism, a corporate structure that is mediating the interaction. And so we see a lot more collaboration and community building. And I think that I hope that continues.
Let's remind our listeners that you're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre, Hudson, and Catskill, Columbia County, Greene County, and going up to Albany County, Dutchess County. And here in the studio, I'll have everybody introduce themselves again. I'm Chad Weckler, by the way.
David Anderson, Walking the Dog Theater.
Kara Benson, Malay Colony for the Arts.
Nicholas Kahn, Kahn and Selesnik.
Richard Selesnik, Conan Selesnik.
And we're all collaborating today in this hour. Let me go back to David, since we have your play premiering this evening, and we have a gallery show premiering today. You can actually go to the Kerry Haddad Photograph Gallery. It's just went up today. Tonight, PS21 is accepting audience members.
Gratefully, cheerfully, enthusiastically. That's right. Starts at 8. Show starts at 8. Runs about an hour and a half without an interval, so you can still have an evening afterwards as well.
And you're playing there all July.
All of July, every weekend, 4 weeks until the 31st.
Since we unfortunately don't have Jonathan Talbot with us today, he's busy at home doing work for you.
Well, for all of us, I hope.
Yeah. Introduce Jonathan for our listening audience.
Jonathan, well, he's quite a famous musician, isn't he, in the community? He's part of several bands and has made quite a name for himself as a composer. Plays lots of instruments, of course. But what can one say? Do you know Jonathan? No. Oh.
No.
So
no.
Not that famous after all.
Maybe we can pull up something from our vast WGXC computer just for a little segue to give people an idea of Jonathan's talent. And he does play with the local band Mother Fletcher. And we're going to put something up by Mother Fletcher.
She's come out on top and now I'm burned. In a high school way, new love pays. Difficult with children are concerned. Not surprised you turn. Your eyes are digging me a deep rug. Your figure draws a long cut. Why I still love you, I do not know. Why I still love you. Nobody's legs, hi-yo. Nobody's face makes me want to burn my house down like yours does. I don't even know you now. It's obvious it's gone too far. You're so vague and I've been played. I'm drawing pictures for you in the bar. On the walls of the bathroom stall. Silence was your statement. Ended our engagement. Why I still want you, I do not know. Why I still want you. Nobody's legs are yours. Nobody's face makes me wanna. Nobody's eyes are as big as yours. Nobody's lips.
And that's Mother Fletcher. Thank you for that. And back to the round table. As we were talking during the break, your life as an artist, maybe we can talk a little bit about that and what it means to you right now, what it did, and what it should 5 years from now. Nicholas, I'll go to you.
yeah.
Let's go to you.
Good luck.
Thanks. Well, I've moved back to Hudson. I was in Coxsackie for 7 years and back in Brooklyn, not meeting enough other artists in Brooklyn, longed more for kind of a community feeling, and coming here to Hudson about a year and a half ago and re-engaging with the kind of community of artists, poets, writers has been marvelous. And the daily walking in the streets and getting someone to come and see your show that's opening up and getting that feedback at the show is a lot less impersonal than in New York City or other cities where we show across the nation, we show in Europe, we're in 10 different galleries constantly doing it. But the community here locally, it feels like it's almost like a college campus, that you can get that quality of intimate crits from your friends who are also working on things, and then pull you in and get you involved in their mad projects. So I'm loving it here, being an artist, and hope to keep building that sense of our art and the community in the back and forth over the next 5 years, I'd say.
Richard?
For me, just to go back to something that was said earlier, it's kind of all about kind of chasing that image. And so for me, I kind of tend to kind of somewhat cloister myself away and just obsessively just try and get to that image. But then it is great to, you know, the moments you're not doing that, that there are other artists around, and then you feel like you're not completely insane for you know, spending all your time doing that. So it is important to have the support also.
Well, when the two of you are collaborating, sounds like you do some digitally over the internet, possibly sometimes in person. What are those processes?
Yeah, it's a lot of back and forthing. We get together at regular intervals and kind of bounce ideas off each other, which is actually one of the kind of most enjoyable parts of collaboration, because that's when you know, all the kind of possibilities you didn't see suddenly become visible?
There's actually a lot of joking, and each other takes the jokes seriously because the jokes tend to come from the subconscious. Mm. And then somewhere in those jokes is often a greater truth. So we're chatting back and forth. We're doing strange little, like, one-inch square drawings, and often I'll take a one-inch square drawing that Rich will do, and I'll blow it up to a foot square and develop that idea further, and then that'll turn into either a photograph or a painting, or a whole concept or a whole series. And we're introducing ideas. I may be off on the internet for like 3 days straight researching a concept and sending links to Richard once I come upon something that feels like somehow tangentially related to this long-term goal that we've been sort of feeling around trying to figure out what this project's about. And then he'll come back to me with some idea from that, and then I'll go further down that other little alleyway. So it's tracking alleyways of concepts until we get to this thing that really kind of vibrates and says, ah, this is alive and it's all sorts of possibilities.
Now, I'm going to segue to Kara, because just by Nicholas talking, and I want to go back to the artist statement, one of the most difficult things to do is to actually write about your, not just your art, but the feelings that are part of that art. Talk about the artist statement a little bit.
Yeah. Well, as a personal artist, I used to find them brutal, and now, I mean, completely brutal. I just thought, and I've heard this from other artists, and I've heard this from artists who've applied, that the work should speak for itself. Mm. I mean, and particularly, I mean, say your art is language art. You know, you've written, well, the words are there. What more should I say? I've said it, haven't I? And yet I have heard from other artists who've applied and in my own experience that the ability to articulate what it is that I think I'm working on has pushed me and pushed other people as artists. It helps to importantly clarify certain projects, and it might lead to something in the work that an artist might not have gotten to just by being in the work. Mm. It's sort of separating out, you know, a lot of, you know, left brain, right brain, critic's brain, artist, creator's brain, and I think they're both important. And so to for the artist to be able to be with the work and sort of the nebulous process, or it can be nebulous process, and then suddenly, I mean, at some point it needs to take its shape, right? You know, like the perfect poem exists until, you know, we put the pen to paper. It's like, you know, it's all up here in the ethereal sphere. And but actually manifesting it into something tangible takes specificity at some point, even as open I want, or anyone wants that specificity to be, is, you know, even in a liminal space, right? That you want something, some sort of definition, or we don't have chairs to sit on, right?
Well, David, as a director, how do you coax the best out of an actor?
Hmm. Oh, wow. It's funny, you know, I would characterize that differently with every production and with every group, because it's always a little different, and people are, you know, that's why I can imagine how difficult it would be to characterize yourself, because it's so evolving and always changing. Once that's down, you're already moved on, and it's already shifting a little bit. But I would say, lately, just between us, I wouldn't let an actor maybe know this, but it's sort of about holding the space for them. Really, what does it mean to hold the space for someone, to give space? Not just stand there and witness, but to create a space in which they can be feel supported, or that where they feel free enough to be creative. I mean, you can be together in a room and not give each other space. Mm. Well, anyone working with people knows what that's like. You can either feel crowded or enabled by that. And so it's a mystery of how one goes about that, but certainly I realize there's a lot more of, I guess, a certain kind of awareness. So in a way, doing less to try to make it happen, and giving space to let it possibly happen, I would say.
Well, since you're also on both sides, what do you find most creative for yourself? The directing, the acting?
Performing? Oh, my goodness, there's such different worlds. I would say, I think I love the improv, but I think I love the directing because this community aspect of it, you know, working with people and people bringing so many different qualities and realizing things because of the differences and because of how they're working. I think you learn a lot more. I think as an actor, you can, as you were saying, you know, you can get caught up in your own process. But as a director, you are with everyone's process. And that's a greater process. So it's slightly, not greater, but, you know, as in a larger, a broadened process. So
I think as artists, we all go through a different auditioning process, you know, whether it's an application process or when someone comes to you and wants to be in a play, you know, having myself done that a long time ago, it's very...
You came and said you wanted to be in a play? I don't remember that.
Oh, no, no. We're talking long time ago. Personally, a lot of nervousness being out there in front of an audience, and you know, whether it's visual arts or writing,
it's a big obstacle. Auditioning process. We've completely reformed the way we try to do auditions because of that very thing. You come in, like I remember, they're coming to audition and they want to look like they're comfortable and creative, and there's so much tension in their body. What now we've tended to do is we'll do like a 2 or 3 hour workshop where they just, whoever's in the room, you know, 30 or 40 people, that they actually start to work together and play together and forget that they're auditioning. And then it's not like I'm on the side looking through a window and seeing, you know, what they're doing, but really try to see how do they engage in the process and what, not just like who's the best for the role, but who belongs to this process and this production. It might not be who's the best. It might not be the most gifted performer. It might be that person who you sense the rest of the group might need. And we cast that way last year. I remember after we cast somebody a week into rehearsals, even though we had a lot of people audition for the role, but nobody felt like the right person. And then we met the person that we were waiting for. Mm. And you just had faith in that process. So, but the audition process is unfortunate. Why we've done this in the theater world, that's one of my biggest complaints, where we've created this torturous system that nobody's happy in. Neither the directors nor the, you know, we just met with some equity people and they were talking about how it's set up now. You get 3 minutes of audition.
Wow.
The director hates it. You can't get to know an actor. Actors hate it because they get 1-3 minutes to show anything of themselves, and nobody realizes anything about anything. So it's an unfortunate process that we're fortunately up here, you know, outside of the city, it can be a little different. And I love, like, you get, what we try to do for auditions is a 3-hour workshop or something, 2-hour workshop, and then half hour with every person, and then get to know them as a person, not as, like, the potential so-and-so, but, you know, how might they, what kind of language can you find together? What kind of collaborative threads do you see possible? And so there's a lot more of that that's possible now, hopefully, because auditioning is torturous.
Well, I'm going to throw one of your questions back at you, talking about trends. Trends in theater, whether it's the writer and what's written, or the person who wants to be in a play. Do they want to be in musicals only? Do they want to be in a one-person play? What trends do you see in theater?
You mean among actors? Or what shows are done?
Yes.
The actors that come towards us are probably more interested in the kind of theater that we're doing, which is more ensemble-based. But as far as plays, wow, it seems like there's a niche out there for everything. I would... I guess the plays that I notice that are speaking to me lately are plays that maybe explore other dimensionalities that we don't maybe see, and that we start to understand them on this plane, so to speak, on this dimension, but we can feel the presence of othernesses, of other dimensions, and that open that mystery up, because it's a mystery that everyone's now familiar with. There's so many programs about it, there's so many things, so many books and all that. But we're beginning to develop a language of our own, every person in their day-to-day lives, a language for this realm of experience. Mm-hmm. And so that's coming more and more even into popular culture and also into plays. I mean, just thinking of this play called, I've forgotten the name, Mark Rylance, was it New York City, which deals with this otherness of life, I guess.
Almost like Mars Adrift.
Yeah. Yeah.
Far afield.
Yeah, that's true. Both Rich and I, the projects we've been thought to do over the time almost always involve trying to uncover that mystery, the otherness, in different permutations, whether it's in the past, the future, or time travel. To both, we rarely deal with straight contemporary society. It's our way of getting outside and creating other worlds.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think in a way all the projects we've done, that's been the central theme, regardless of what the ostensible subject matter is. That's always the underlying kind of subtext of it.
Kara, when we're talking about the artists, what's wonderful about the colony is that it takes many different artists. You can be visual and writing. Back to sort of trends again, is there anything specific that you see coming from the artists rooted that it's not normally seen, that's maybe hidden behind the veil a little bit?
One of the things that I think we've seen at the colony, because so many artists do come up from Brooklyn and they have much smaller studio spaces, and then they come to the colony and they have these tremendous rooms to work in, we notice that a lot of artists who typically work in two dimension will pop into the third dimension with their work. And that has been really exciting to see. We were just looking in someone's studio last month, and she was astonished to suddenly be working with materials and hanging from the ceiling by fishing line, and things seemed to, she seemed to be manifesting this otherness, sort of a web-like, synapsy, sinewy material sort of woven through the studio space. And typically she was a two-dimensional artist prior to that. So I don't know if that is something that's in the air, or something that the space provides. I do think that people go to different places, though. They come thinking they're going to work on something. They come thinking that this is their project, and then being there and then being in the actual space might bring something else forward. So, and it's in many ways very hidden while they're there. It's very, they have a lot of safe space to do that.
What's coming up at Colony? I understand there's an open house.
We have an open house on July 23rd. That's our annual fundraiser. It's how we get to do what we do, which is provide the space for artists to make their work. It doesn't cost anything as an artist to come and stay at the Colony. And occasionally we even can get a stipend to help cover some travel and living expenses for while they're there. But primarily it's completely free for an artist to come. So somebody's got to pick up that bill. We do have some very generous donors, and then we open it up to the public once a year to come and be on the property, visit with the studios, party. And that's on July 23rd. All the information is at our website, malaycolony.org. And also the other thing I'll just put in is that September 15th is our annual deadline for applications for any artists out there considering applying it. September 15th, and then July 23rd is the open house.
Nicholas and Richard, what's coming up for the two of you?
Well, this Saturday from 6 to 8 at Carrihadad Photographs, which is at 318 Warren Street, we have the actual kind of party opening for the Mars Adrift at the Hourglass Sea. And we also are going to be doing, we have a space on the corner of Warren and 7th called History Laboratory, which is a more experimental space where we're showing other people, and we have our drawing and other projects, and we're showing that at the NADA Art Fair that's going to be in Hudson on the 30th and 31st of July, that weekend. So that'll be a big project there as well.
The best place to get information is at the NADA website or the Basilica website?
Not sure.
Let's say both of them.
Yes.
David, besides the play this month, what's Walking the Dog doing?
We have a benefit at Hudson Basilica in September, and then we open a new show, which is going to be a surprise show, which is going to be a devised piece in October, and then November, a new play, which a group of us from the ensemble has also been devising for the last few months. And then every year we do a Christmas carol at Space 360, and that'll return as well in December.
Well, I'm going to close out this hour. I want to thank our guests for coming here. And people, come back a month from now, or stay tuned at WGXC 90.7 FM all the time, because community radio is here. It's It's made by your neighbors, your friends, and people, if you don't know, you will know very soon. This is Chad Weckler for the Art of the Hudson Valley. Thank you.
Welcome.